thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's having a voice treatment and will be back on the air soon. The Supreme Court ruled last Thursday that the First Amendment applies to corporations as well as citizens. The decision sent shockwaves through the political world. Joining me in the studio this hour to discuss the opinion and its ramifications in American campaigns, Jon Barron, former general counsel to the Republican National Committee, Jerry Hebert with the Campaign Legal Center, and Eliza Newland Carney of National Journal. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi,
thanks for having us.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Well, Eliza, give us just a quick overview of what it was the Supreme Court decided.
Well, the Supreme Court decided that corporations could now spend money independently of campaigns directly from their corporate treasuries. That had been prohibited before. It also eliminated some constraints on corporate spending close to an election that had existed in the McCain-Feingold law. And while certain things were left in place, including the soft money ban and disclosure regulations and the ban on direct corporate contributions to candidates and parties, it certainly represents a dramatic shift in the court's overall thinking about what is a corporation and what are the protections around the First Amendment.
So, Jon, how much of a surprise was this?
It was not a surprise to me. In the aftermath of the oral arguments in September on this case, it looked pretty clear that there was going to be a majority of the court members who were likely to strike down this restriction, which I would characterize slightly differently than Eliza has, because corporate spending and union spending in elections in certain forms is legal, has been permitted, and is quite prevalent. In fact, the Tuesday election in Massachusetts, which came just 2 days before the Supreme Court decision, there was $2.7 million spent by corporations and unions just in Massachusetts. And when they spend money and mention the name of a candidate in a pre-election period, they have to file reports with the Federal Election Commission, which is how we know how much spending went on in that race.
So what's the critical change with this court decision?
The critical change in this decision pertains to the content of advertising that corporations and unions may sponsor in campaigns. Up to this point, the law prohibited corporations and unions, and this is the federal law, by the way, not state law. 26 states in the District of Columbia don't have this restriction, but federal law in the other states do not permit corporations, unions, in the content of their advertising to say vote for or vote against a named candidate. They can say just about anything else, but they can't use what are called the magic words.
Jerry, Jon says this wasn't a surprise, says corporations already were spent and unions already were spending money on campaigns. So why did this decision cause such a stir among groups like your own?
Well, it's a disaster for the American people, and it's a dark day for the court when the court allows corporations to unleash unlimited amounts of money, in influence-seeking money, into our elections. I disagree with Jon that I think it really just regulated the content of ads. I think what you're really seeing here is that they've unleashed the corporate influence-buying corruption that we will now see. Corporations for over 100 years have been barred from contributing to candidates, and since Taft-Hartley have been barred from spending money directly to elect or defeat candidates. And now look at the amount of money corporate America has. They just spent $30-something million in 2009 to influence the health care bill, and we still aren't finished.
Was this decision a surprise to you in the wake of the oral arguments, or did you also expect it to come out this way?
Well, in the wake of the oral arguments, I certainly didn't feel like I could predict that, you know, our side would win. But I did find it troubling that, you know, the Supreme Court had just upheld the McCain-Feingold law in 2003, and just a couple of years ago had examined this particular provision of law and had upheld it again over the strong objections of Justice Scalia. So I was surprised.
So, Eliza, the Supreme Court made a different decision just a few years ago upholding the McCain-Feingold law. What has changed in that time?
Well, the main thing is that Sandra Day O'Connor has left the court, and she's been replaced by Alito. And we also have Roberts in charge of the court, and he's taken a very strong deregulatory tilt.
And yet, is this common, do you think, Jan, and appropriate for the membership on the Supreme Court to change? And so the Supreme Court's direction on a law like this to shift so much in a few years?
Well, it's not common, but it's also not unique. And in recent years, we've had other constitutional principles reversed in a relatively short period of time. I think the best-known example is state anti-sodomy laws, which some 20 years ago were upheld as constitutional in a case coming from Georgia, and I think about 16 or 17 years later, the court reversed that decision in a case that came from Texas. And of course, you know, the best known example of a dramatic 180-degree reversal by the Supreme Court came in the case involving segregation at public schools, the Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954 reversed a case from 1898 that said just the opposite. So it may take different periods of time, but the idea that the court overrules mistakes that it made in the past is not only not unique, but I would think would be welcome, since the court should not stick to mistakes.
And yet Chief Justice Roberts said he described his approach to the court as being calling balls and strikes and not seeking to overturn precedents kind of for the sake of doing so. Is this at odds with what he said he was going to do on the court?
I don't think so. I think what has happened here is that there have been, as Jerry suggested, an incremental shift by the court to this particular position. Two or three years ago, the court struck down part of this McCain-Feingold advertising restriction in order to allow issue advertising by corporations and unions. They struck down, in a separate case, a provision in McCain-Feingold that penalized so-called millionaire candidates and jerry-rigged campaigns. That was struck down. And I think what happened in this case was that in March of last year, this case was argued for the first time. And during that argument, the government lawyers were asked, well, does this constitutional principle and this law permit the government to ban books funded by corporations that contain these magic words of vote for or against a candidate? And the government responded by saying yes. Which is an accurate response. That's the interpretation, correct interpretation of the law. And once the members of the court, including Chief Justice Roberts, heard that, they said, well, you know, we better bring everybody back for a second round of arguments in September to discuss this principle, because it certainly doesn't sound consistent with the First Amendment.
Jerry, what's your perspective?
Well, let's start, with John Roberts and his so-called commitment to judicial modesty and respect for precedent. This case was anything but. He's really abandoned those. You know, when he testified in front of the Congress in his confirmation hearings, he said that when you overrule a longstanding legal precedent, it's a real jolt to the legal system. That's his quote. He said that precedent plays an important role in promoting even-handedness and stability in the law. He even said, Susan, that when you are a justice and looking at settled cases, you really have to look at whether or not, do people really have settled expectations that the law will continue? What effect will overruling the precedent have on the legitimacy of the court? He also said you have to look at whether or not the precedent that's being overruled has proved to be unworkable or not. And then you have to look at whether or not the longstanding precedent has been eroded by subsequent developments. Well, under all those factors, there's no cause for the court to do what it did in this case. This case started out as a very narrow, limited attack on one particular provision of McCain-Feingold to show Hillary the movie, and the Supreme Court expanded it on its own.
So why did the court choose to do this?
Well, this is a right-wing corporate America court, and they did it to protect big business. That's why they did it. And this court has shown very little deference to the Congress that studied for years and years and tried to remedy the scandal of big money in politics by enacting the McCain-Feingold bill.
I want to give you a chance just to respond to that, Jan. Is this a right-wing court that is acting to protect big business?
I think this is an ideologically conservative court that believes that the First Amendment says what it says, that Congress shall pass no law to abridge the freedom of speech and other freedoms. What has evolved over the last 30 or 40 years is really a polarization on the court that preceded this particular case between two very philosophically different approaches to the First Amendment and how it can or cannot regulate campaign financing.
So, Eliza, how far-reaching will the impact of this decision be? Is it going to have a big impact, for instance, on the elections we're going to have in November?
I think, frankly, as far as November goes, it's a little hard to predict exactly how it will play out. I think there's little question that more groups will weigh in and that their activities will probably be less transparent and certainly less regulated than they were before. But I think one reason why this case is viewed as sort of a small revolution in campaign financing is not even simply because of the immediate impact, but because of the implications for other existing campaign finance laws. All sorts of things that we now have, such as the soft money ban, such as the disclosure rules, such as the ban on direct corporate contributions, now may be vulnerable to constitutional challenge, given that this court is, in fact, quite protective of the First Amendment.
Eliza Newland Carney is a contributing editor for National Journal and author of the weekly election law column Rules of the Game at nationaljournal.com. And we're also joined this hour by Jan Behrend, an attorney who specializes in election law. He's the former general counsel to the Republican National Committee. And Jerry Hebert, executive director and director of litigation at the Campaign Legal Center. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go to your calls and questions. You can reach us at 1-800-433-8850 or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio, Jerry Hebert of the Campaign Legal Center, Eliza Newland Carney of National Journal, and Jan Behrend, an attorney in private practice who specializes in election law. We're talking about that Supreme Court decision from last week that caused such a ripple in the political world. Here's an email we got from Robert, who's writing us from New York. He says, how is it that corporations have constitutional rights? Corporations are not mentioned in the Constitution. They are artificial entities created by the legislature, and they have no rights that the legislature does not give them. What's next? Corporations get the right to vote or to run for office? What do you think, Jan? Why are corporations deserving of First Amendment protections?
Well, in fact, they are a form of association, which, by the way, is also protected in the First Amendment. First Amendment has five basic freedoms. I mean, it's press, speech, association, the right to petition government, and the Establishment Clause regarding religion. Corporations have, for a century, been recognized in Supreme Court jurisprudence as being persons having an existence and having constitutional rights. And, of course, corporations are not disembodied, you know, phantasms. They consist of people. There are employees. There are stockholders for companies that have stock. There are customers. And in fact, it's that form that enables some very important corporations in our society to exercise their freedom under the First Amendment, namely newspapers and media corporations. Those are all corporations. If your caller or listener is to say, well, there shouldn't be any rights, then presumably Congress could pass a law that says, well, you know, newspapers should be restricted in the same way as campaigns. And I don't think anybody is proposing that.
Jerry?
Listen, Robert from New York hits the nail right on the head with that question, because to say corporations are people or that spending is speech, all those are lofty phrases to give wealthy people and big business the opportunity to spend, and give them constitutional cover under the First Amendment. Think about corporations. They have perpetual life. They get special tax advantages. They have the ability to amass unlimited amounts of money and then spend it. Even former Chief Justice Rehnquist had a problem with allowing corporations to spend in elections. And if you don't agree with me, Jan, about what the majority ruling in this case really does, the Fortune 100 companies alone had a combined revenue of $13 trillion and profits of $605 billion in the last election cycle. That's the potential that this case has.
Well, what about Jan's point that if you can restrict corporations' constitutional rights, if you don't extend constitutional protections to them, that media companies could be subject to limitations?
Well, media companies were exempted under the McCain-Feingold bill because they are the most fundamental First Amendment corporation, and they shouldn't be restricted. But let's just also unmask the idea that McCain-Feingold banned corporations and unions from speaking. It did no such thing. It simply said that they have to use their PAC money if they want to run these ads, and that they just can't use their Treasury money.
Yeah, I think it's very charitable of Congress to have exempted media corporations. Isn't that a nice thing that it's only within the power of Congress to give them a special status? It's not the First Amendment under Jerry's argument. And, of course, that's a fallacious argument because media is exercising First Amendment rights of press and speech and association. And just because they are a corporation does not deny them the protections of the First Amendment.
Eliza?
Two quick points. One is that the implications of saying that corporations should be treated as individuals are far-reaching, not only for existing campaign finance law, but for other areas of the law as well. And there are consumer groups that are very concerned that this may have implications for consumer protections.
Like what sort of things could you see?
Well, for example, if a corporation makes a claim that can't be substantiated, which is harmful to consumers, but the court has decided that they have an absolute freedom of speech, then consumer groups are concerned they might not be able to contain that or constrain it in any way. I should note, too, that even media First Amendment rights are not absolute. Media corporations may not engage in libelous coverage. They need to respect privacy rights. They need to respect copyright. And therefore, that even within the context of media law, the First Amendment is not absolute.
Well, the decision left standing some restrictions on corporations, like directly contributing to a federal campaign. If corporations are like citizens in the eyes of the law, do constitutional protections, why should there be that kind of restriction? Why shouldn't corporations be able to contribute directly to campaigns?
Well, the way the First Amendment works is just because you have a First Amendment right or any constitutional right doesn't mean that it's unfettered and unrestricted. The government has the responsibility and the opportunity to come forward and say, well, under certain circumstances, even though this participant or this speaker has a First Amendment right, we have concluded that it's in the interest of the society and good government to impose certain restrictions. Now, the Supreme Court accepted that argument when it came to contributions, whether it's a contribution from an individual or a political committee, from a wealthy billionaire or the biggest corporation, presumably, would be subject to the same analysis. There is a law that continues to prohibit corporations and unions from making any contribution to any candidate for president or the House or the Senate. If a corporation were to start a case and say, well, we think we should be allowed to make contributions, the government will come in and say, well, we don't think so. We don't think so at all, perhaps, would be their argument. Or at the very least, they would say, if a corporation has a right to make a contribution. They should have no greater right than an individual, and that individual today may not contribute more than $2,400 to a candidate. That is the way the analysis will work, and it will depend on the government to be able to come forward and demonstrate the interest, which I think they will easily be able to do when it comes to contributions. They were not able to do that in this case because we weren't talking about contributions. We were talking about independent spending, somebody spending some money for an ad on a radio or television station or a newspaper saying, this is our opinion of this public policy and this candidate's position on this policy. And when it comes to any other speaker under our court cases, whether it's a wealthy individual or a political committee or even a political party, the Supreme Court has uniformly said you cannot place a dollar limit on that type of independent speech. You can require disclosure, but you cannot limit that speech.
Jan, you've worked on a lot of campaigns, and I wonder, do you have any concerns at all that this is going to just flood corporate money into federal elections, into House and Senate elections, in a way that's not good for our democracy?
Well, I will be interested, as Eliza suggested, to see how this evolves. Now, we can't, you know, we're not operating in a vacuum. As I mentioned early on, every state in the District of Columbia has its own rules for its own campaigns, elections for governor, state legislature, a county commissioner. And as I said, 26 states and the District of Columbia today, and even before the Citizens United decision, did not place any limit on independent spending of any sort by corporations and unions. And we addressed in a brief that my firm filed on behalf of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce the fact that there is no evidence of flooding of corporate or union money in those states, including big states like California or Washington State. And we even pointed to some studies that were conducted about independent spending in those states. And what they discovered is that if there is a trickle, let alone a flood of money in the form of independent spending, it doesn't come from corporations. It tends to come from unions, and even Indian tribes spend more than corporations in those states.
Well, Jerry, has there been a negative impact in state elections that allow corporations to do this kind of spending?
Well, I don't think we really know the answer, unfortunately, but there have been obviously some examples of scandals and corruption in states that allow corporate spending. But because corporations have been restricted at the federal level for so long and those restrictions have been kind of taken for granted and the Supreme Court has noted them with approval for 100 years, there really hasn't been an effort to really uncover all of that. But if you look at the soft money ban that went into effect with McCain-Feingold, that ban was put into effect because of unlimited corporate contributions to major parties and candidates, and there was corruption. And so there's no reason to think that corporate spending in the political process is not going to lead to that same problem.
Eliza, you also mentioned the soft money ban. Explain to our listeners what the soft money ban is.
Well, there was a time when the political parties could accept unlimited money for so-called party building. But the party building sort of quickly translated itself into things like ads or issue ads that didn't explicitly say vote for or vote against a candidate. And so that ban, interestingly enough, was predicted to be something that would hurt the political parties. In fact, the political parties sort of flowered in the wake of that ban because instead of getting all these massive individual donations from multimillionaires, they got all these little contributions over the internet, which has been an interesting and some would say positive development.
Well, it's certainly true that almost every time campaign finance rules are changed, there are unintended consequences that we didn't predict. Well, let's go to the phones. We'll talk first to Bob, who's calling us from Matthews, North Carolina. Bob, you're on the air.
Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm afraid, I fear, that the discussion thus far in the media has been perhaps a bit myopic because it does not appear that there's anything in this Supreme Court decision that would prevent foreign companies with U.S. subsidiaries from funding United States campaigns, or to put a finer point on it, China, as an example, holding billions in United States Treasury notes, it appears to me is now in a position through its corporations and their subsidiaries to directly influence and control United States elections.
Well, Eliza, is that true? Can foreign companies also spend money?
This case actually did not directly address foreign companies, and that's a matter of concern for Congress. And among the things that are now being considered on Capitol Hill are measures that would ban American subsidiaries of foreign-owned companies from making direct political expenditures.
Does that concern you, Jan, or do you think that this is not something to be worried about?
Well, the court, in its opinion, specifically stated that this issue is left for another day because the law that regulates contributions or spending by foreign corporations is a separate statute from the one that the court addressed here in Citizens United. I think that in oral argument it became clear that if and when that statute is challenged, then the government will have the same burden it had in this in other cases. It has to come forward and say, well, we need to treat foreign corporations differently than domestic corporations. I also found it interesting that during oral argument, one of the justices asked one of the advocates, well, in our jurisprudence, would we treat a news corporation owned by a foreign company any differently than we would treat a U.S. corporation? Is there any precedent for that? And the answer was there's no precedent. So it will raise, again, the same issues we've been discussing in the last half hour.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to call us, our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. So in order to restrict foreign companies from spending on federal elections, it's going to take an additional passage of another law to do that.
Well, no, there is an existing law right now that does restrict foreign corporations and foreign nationals from contributing to campaigns and spending. But what the Supreme Court's decision really opens up is the opportunity for domestic corporations that have foreign interests to really spend money in federal elections. And that's a danger, frankly, for the reasons that Bob, your caller, identified.
Well, if, as you were saying, Jan, people, foreign citizens who live in this country are extended constitutional protections.
Certain constitutional, the current statute regulating foreign nationals says that if a foreign citizen has been admitted to the United States for permanent residence, mm-hmm. they can be given the same rights under these campaign finance laws as any American citizen. But other foreign citizens who might be here on a work or a student visa don't have those rights. When it comes to U.S. corporations that may be owned by a foreign company, the law and the Federal Election Commission regulations make it very clear that foreign nationals may not participate in those political activities. And also, if there is going to be a contribution, and of course, contributions from corporations in the U.S. are legal in 28 states, then the money that is donated by this U.S. subsidiary must come from U.S. commercial activity and not be money that is transmitted here to the U.S. To the subsidiary.
We're getting a lot of callers and emails expressing concern about how much power this may give corporations in the political system. Here's a note we got from Phil on Facebook. He says, will senators wear their sponsors' names on jackets or only have plaques on their desks? And he goes on with a perhaps more serious question, saying, what about the Fair Elections Act that would bring clean elections to the federal level? How is that impacted, and can we get it? Eliza, does this affect the prospects for some new election laws?
Certainly advocates of public financing feel that this ruling is going to give them a jolt. They're very excited that there are almost 130 co-sponsors in the House for a law that would underwrite congressional campaigns with public financing. They're also pushing very hard for public financing for presidential races. And I think it's fair to say that even before this ruling, a lot of academics and experts and advocates of campaign finance reforms really felt that the writing was on the wall in terms of the direction this court was taking, that there are going to be fewer and fewer constitutional constraints on campaign spending, and that they're feeling is that the suitable response is to therefore empower small donors. It would be very difficult for the court to say it's unconstitutional for people to give small contributions. And therefore, there's a movement afoot both within the academic world and within the advocacy community to really push for public financing that empowers small donors.
But, Jerry, public financing of campaigns has been very controversial, has not gotten very far. Do you think the climate has changed enough so that that might actually happen?
Well, I certainly think that there's a better opportunity for it now than there was before the Citizens United decision. you see what's happened, Susan, and I think we all perhaps can agree on this one point, which is that there seems to be, for those who I would characterize as the those who want to have big money back into our political system, there really seems to be a feeding frenzy right now. How many cases can we get to the Supreme Court with this corporate America justices that we have, and how fast can we get them to decide and strike down as many restrictions as possible? I think that sets the stage for an opportunity for public financing and a lot of other restrictions on spending to stop big business.
Jerry Hebert, he's executive director and director of litigation at the Campaign Legal Center. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to talk on the phone with Congressman Chris Van Hollen. He heads the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. We'll talk with him about what kind of impact he thinks this ruling will have on November's midterm elections, and also what he hopes to do to restrict and change the results, the impact of the decision. We'll go to the phones, too. We're at 1-800-433-8850. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Rocco Landisman produced Broadway mega hits, including Angels in America and The Producers. He explains why he's come to Washington to chair the National Endowment for the Arts. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. On the phone now with us is Maryland Congressman Chris Van Hollen. He's serving his fourth term in Congress, and he's the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Congressman, thank you for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
Now, the Supreme Court decision that came out last week, how much impact do you think it's going to have on the elections this November?
Well, it has the potential to have a huge impact by opening up the floodgates to corporate special interest money. I mean, we still don't know exactly how corporations will react, but now they will, of course, be able to spend money directly to try and elect or defeat a candidate, whereas currently they have to sort of siphon the money through other organizations and entities, and there are additional limits on top of that. So the danger of a huge amount of corporate money flooding the campaigns is real. And that's why we're going to be doing what we can to blunt the impact, because this represents a enormous transfer of power, we believe, to corporations at the expense of average citizens.
Of course, this ruling affected corporations and unions. Unions tend to support Democrats. Why doesn't this? Why is this? Do you think this is such an advantage for Republicans? Such a danger for Democrats?
Well, I think the greater concern here is that it endangers the American democracy, and I think it does greatly strengthen the hand of big corporations. And whatever rules we would apply in trying to temper the impact of this would, of course, apply equally to corporations and unions. Unions, of course, raise their money from the donations of working people. And I think it's pretty clear if you look at the Fortune 100 companies that the union contributions and monies can't possibly compete with big corporate money. I would actually hope this is something that Republicans join Democrats on. Senator McCain said he was disappointed in the Supreme Court's ruling. I think regardless of what political party you belong to, this should be a wake-up call. And certainly many of the people around the country who have been part of the Tea Party movement and who are worried that, you know, big corporations are dictating policy in Washington should be alarmed with this. So it's possible we'll have a strong coalition to deal with this issue.
Now, I know that you and Senator Chuck Schumer from New York are working on legislation. What would the bill that you're working on do?
Well, we're exploring our options, and this Supreme Court decision is written very expansively, and so it will take some time to really pinpoint where we can limit its impact. But just to give you some ideas, we're looking at requiring that shareholders approve the expenditure of money for these campaign ads. We require that the sort of the stand by your ad requirement. So the CEO of a company would have to get on the television at the end of the ad and say, I'm the chairman of so-and-so corporation, and I stand by this ad. We're certainly looking at limiting the ability of foreign corporations, U.S. subsidiaries of foreign corporations, from spending money here, because one of the possibilities is that a foreign corporation whose main interests are really overseas is able now to participate and spend a lot of money in the American political process. And then there are questions about deductibility of these expenses. Why should corporations be able to write these off as business expenses? After all, corporations are creations of law, in many cases at the state level, but they also have federal benefits. And so that's another area that we're looking at.
Representative Van Hollen, Congress has no shortage of things to do at the moment. Health care reform, working on promoting jobs in this country. What are the prospects that this, whatever legislation you end up thinking is wise and proposed, what are the prospects that Congress can act on it quickly?
Well, I think Congress will move fairly quickly on this. So certainly Senator Schumer and I and others intend to introduce legislation quickly. This goes to the core of all of the other issues we're talking about. I mean, let's just take the whole question of holding Wall Street accountable. If members of Congress are looking at whether AIG or a major corporation is going to spend millions of dollars trying to defeat them if they want to hold Wall Street firms accountable, that obviously has a impact on the political process. Healthcare, health insurance companies, we know already we're siphoning money indirectly into a lot of the ads to try and defeat healthcare reform. So this goes to the core of all the issues that we're dealing with, whether it's healthcare, energy, Wall Street accountability. And so I think it's going to be a priority to try and address this issue so that you don't totally tip the playing field in favor of big corporate special money in elections.
All right. Congressman Chris Van Hollen, thank you so much for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Congressman Hollen, who is from Maryland, heads the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Well, Jan, what did you think about what he had to say?
Well, I was struck that he didn't mention public financing as sort of a solution here. It wasn't even on his radar screen, and I think likely because it really has no prayer in this Congress. Now, whether any of his other proposals will satisfy either political or constitutional criteria remains to be seen. Let's see what they come up with. But he also mentioned that, they are apparently going to propose, stopping these ads about health care reform. I don't know how they can do that. I mean, that wasn't constitutional even to stop such advertising even before the Citizens United case. So he seems to be straying far afield and certainly not in line with the constitutional principles that he's going to have to satisfy.
Well, Eliza, do you think Democrats are having trouble kind of figuring out how to respond legislatively to this ruling?
Well, I think there are a short-term and a long-term strategy. I think what Congressman Van Hollen was addressing are the short-term priorities, and I think that we may see these either introduced as little as a week or 2 weeks from now and or discussed in hearings. Senator Schumer chairs the Rules Committee, and I think, if nothing else, Democrats are going to try to take advantage of the opportunity to talk about their antipathy to corporate power, corporate influence. Obviously, one of the messages they got from Massachusetts was, you don't get it, Americans are upset. And this is certainly one way for them to assert that, in fact, they do hear those concerns.
Let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to Susan. She's calling us from Whitehall, Arkansas. Susan, thank you for joining us.
Oh, good morning. I listened to Melissa Block interview Newt Gingrich on All Things Considered last week when the opinion came down. And he repeatedly stated this was an advantageous opinion for the middle class. And at the end of the interview, I was still no clearer how that could be. Now, granted, Melissa should have pushed him more, but can you panel expand on that if any of them heard that interview? And we've heard so much about how this is going to be good for corporations. Is there going to be any advantage to the middle class? Because, quite frankly, I can't see it.
All right, Susan, thanks for your call. What do you think, panel?
Well, let me start out, Susan, by saying that anybody who thinks this is a victory for the middle class is, to put it mildly, sadly mistaken. This is an opportunity for major corporate money to be unleashed in the political process to drown out the voice of the middleman or the middle class person or the Joe the plumber. You know, it was once said that there are two things that are important in politics. The first is money, and the person couldn't remember what the second one was. Well, you know, big corporations and lobbyists get it. What this decision allows to happen, and this really goes to this middle class question, what this really allows is for corporations and lobbyists to go to members of Congress and say, gee, are you going to vote for our bailout bill? Because, you know, we're going to spend $10 or $15 million against you in the upcoming election if you don't. And there's going to be a big shakedown. And the American public got to realize that this decision undermines our democracy and is the most corrupting decision of our campaign finance system in the history of our country.
Well, Jan, do you think that could happen, that corporations' power to affect what legislators do gets greatly expanded by their ability to spend on federal elections?
I don't know. And I'm just not as confident as Jerry is about what's going to happen here. And the reason is that I've studied, you know, what corporations do in these states that basically have allowed companies to do what now the Supreme Court says they can do in federal elections, and I just don't see the evidence of that. And I think there are maybe several reasons for that. Number one, of course, corporations really are not in the business of politics. They're in the business of making things or providing services. Yes, they are concerned about how government affects them, as is any organization or entity, but they're really in contrast to labor unions. You know, that their business is politics. I mean, in fact, the only area of growth in union membership is unionized government workers. So they're really interested in what government is doing. And when they get involved in politics, they give 95% to 98% of their money to Democrats. They're monolithic. The business community is not monolithic. It may have these rights, but you know, one of the things about constitutional rights is having a right doesn't compel you to exercise it. And I don't see any evidence of the business community exercising these rights in a dramatically different fashion than they have in states.
Eliza, let me pose to you Susan's question, which was, is there a way in which this is empowering for the middle class, which was Newt Gingrich's point?
Well, I'd like to specifically address what corporations are going to do at this time. I think it's fair to say that companies like Nike and Coca-Cola may be reluctant to jump in and suddenly support or oppose political candidates for fear of alienating consumers. That could be a little bit dangerous from an economic point of view. At the same time, I think it's fair to say that they will be donating quite freely to some of the groups that represent them, business associations, organizations that are politically active, which may have very nice names that don't immediately say what they're up to. And that's one of the reasons I said earlier that this may affect transparency, that we may have a lot of corporate money that goes into organizations that becomes a little harder to trace. I do think that the corporate voice has the potential to be magnified here. And I don't necessarily see a connection in terms of promoting middle class values.
Is there a risk for corporations that choose to get very engaged in politics, risk either with their shareholders, with their customers. What do you think, Jan?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as I said, corporations are not in the business of alienating consumers, customers, or government officials. And, of course, we can take a look at, for example, the contribution patterns of political action committees that are sponsored by corporations. This has been allowed now for some 40 years, and there's, a couple of striking features. Number one is that they almost 98% of their money goes to incumbents. And two-thirds of the money will go to the incumbents of whatever party is controlling the House or the Senate at that time. So that doesn't look like the political pattern of a sector of our society that now wants to go out and spend millions of dollars on controversial advertising that might alienate any of these public officials. And it's not the pattern that we've experienced in the states where this type of activity is permitted.
Jerry, do you think that's reassuring?
Not at all. Insurance companies, drug companies, banks, energy companies, all the things that we're debating in 2010 and beyond, they're now free to each spend $5, $10 million on any election to defeat an office holder and thereby try to buy influence. And that's why you see the contributions that Jan was talking about. They're really trying to have influence on issues of economic importance to the corporation.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to Marvin. He's calling us from Dallas. Marvin, you're on the air.
Well, good morning. I just wanted to ask if we've decided that corporations are persons and they have the full constitutional rights, is it legal to own one?
All right. Thanks for your call, Marvin. Any response from the panel, Jan?
Well, two-thirds of the American public does own corporations. They own stock in corporations, and that's just the public corporations. Of course, there are millions of corporations that aren't public. They're owned by entrepreneurs, usually families or single stockholders. So, yes, it's widespread, as the court noted in its opinion, and it's not unfavored in our society for people to have corporations.
Here's an email from Alan. He writes, if corporations are allowed to contribute to candidates, what is there to stop the Saudi royal family from creating a U.S.-based corporation just to influence American politics? Would that be possible now, Eliza?
No, because this decision doesn't say that corporations may contribute to candidates. It says they may spend independently. But I need to point something out about this question of independent expenditures. What is independent? That's going to be a question that really bogs down a lot of political players now. The question of what constitutes coordination with a candidate or party. Does that mean if you talk to the candidate or a party official one time during the election that you've coordinated? Does it mean you've shared talking points? Does it mean you've shared ad messages? So Congress and the Federal Election Commission have really struggled, frankly, with that definition, and this is really going to put it to them to come up with a clear explanation of what constitutes coordination.
Now, does this decision affect the ability to coordinate, a corporation to coordinate with a campaign?
In theory, they should not be coordinating. Therefore, they need to stay independent. But as I say, the definition of what constitutes an independent expenditure is not very clear right now.
Jerry, you're nodding your head.
Yes, I agree with that. But as I said earlier, this is really opening the door for the feeding frenzy at the Supreme Court by those who are opposed to campaign finance regulations. They see the opportunity in this corporate wing of the court to unleash huge amounts of money and to strike down every restriction they can.
And you've been involved in a lot of the court cases that have come up on campaign finance. Do you expect us to see more cases being brought now?
I think there will be some additional cases. Of course, there are cases pending right now in lower federal courts. In fact, this week there's going to be an argument in a case before the entire circuit court here in the District of Columbia about whether it is constitutional to impose limits on donations to groups that want to make independent expenditures. Independent expenditures cannot be limited, but the Federal Election Commission has taken the position over the last 40 years that if you contribute to such a group, your donation is subject to a contribution limit. So there'll be challenges of that sort. I don't see any challenges, and if there are any, I don't see any likelihood of success at all to challenge limits on what you can give to a candidate. if you want to give money to a candidate or collaborate with that candidate in the way you spend, which is treated as an in-kind contribution, that money is going to be subject to a limit, and it's going to be upheld under the First Amendment.
Eliza, quickly, is there a case you're watching that may come up next?
There are a couple of cases, one involving the Republican National Committee, which is challenging the soft money ban, and one involving a group called Speech Now, which is also challenging existing limits. And I think those are very significant cases which could be directly affected by this ruling.
Eliza Newland Carney, Jerry Hebert, Jan Behrend, thank you so much for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you for having us.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.